Welcome, everyone, to episode 354 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a loaded episode for you today. We are going to do some postmortems on the Sixers and Pacers now that they've been eliminated from the bubble. We will also preview the Celtics-Raptors series and make some predictions on what's going to happen in the two most competitive Western Conference series, Houston-OKC and Clippers-Mavericks. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews, and we are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a guy whose Blazers over the Lakers prediction is suddenly not looking so hot. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
Oh, man, you're just doing me dirty right off the bat, huh? Wow. No, they aren't, but in my defense, the Lakers started hitting shots. That's what I said. That could be a game changer. I didn't trust their supporting cast, and like last night they hit, was it 17 threes?
Yeah, I mean, last night was just an absolute barnstorming from, like, the Blazers ran out of gas, which is...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, it's understandable. I'm not crapping on the Blazers today, and I haven't seen... Are we still awaiting results on Dame's MRI?
Yeah, so that means, obviously, that while we're recording, probably while we're wrapping up, Roach is going to drop something. So yeah. But I will say this. I actually like this. I like this development because the Lakers in the seeding games were... I don't want to say trash because I hate that word. I don't think that's fair. But they were bad. I don't think there's any definition where you could go, oh, they were playing well, they were playing good. No, they were playing bad. So for them to flip this switch now is encouraging for them, and this is what I wanted to see out of them.
Yeah, they were disappointing. They no longer seem disappointing. And, I mean, we'll see what happens in these other series, but it's setting up like a... I mean, at this point, I feel like you'd probably have to take the Lakers as the clear favorite to make the Western Conference Finals out of any other team left in the pool, right?
Given like the trouble that the Clippers are running into?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously this is not a prediction or anything. This is just like a hypothetical. Just in terms of like a sports story, like you and I are both in the sports writing business.
Regrettably.
Amen. Let's just play it out for funsies. Dallas makes the finals and they win the whole thing. Luka Doncic is 21, you know, finals MVP and whatnot. What would that like do to just, you know, his brand, the narrative around him, like sports writing in particular? Like, what the sport would have to be covered completely differently for the next couple of months.
I know one draft analyst in particular who would never be allowed back on Twitter.
Man, you are being very, very kind in calling him an analyst.
Whatever you call him, but yeah, it would be like I hope I'm rooting for chaos at this point. But yeah, before we get started here, we will get to the postmortems in a second. But first, I just want to offer my condolences to the family of Jacob Blake and, honestly, to any of our Black listeners out there. Like, I have no idea what you are going through right now. And, you know, at this point, it just feels like it's every damn day. You just have to wake up and wonder who's next. And we just need to be better. And it's, you know, I know we have a lot of international listeners out here, too. And it's, if you want to dunk on America right now, you should and you can, because we are doing an exceptionally bad job in a lot of areas right now. But this is not just an American issue. Racism and prejudice is not just an American thing. And, you know, again, kudos to the NBA for doing all that they are throughout the bubble in addressing these issues. I mean, Chris Paul and LeBron James both used their post-game nationally televised press conference to discuss this rather than anything that just happened in the game, which was, you know, just such a great, powerful message for them to send. So I'm, from an NBA fan perspective, I am genuinely thrilled that these guys are using their voice and their platform to deliver a much needed message right now, but we all need to do better. This just sucks.
Yeah. Man, you know, sometimes we get the messages, you know, we read every message we get, and sometimes we get those, you know, stick to sports things. And I think those are actually part of the issue. Those are a tremendous part of the issues, because if we keep, you know, going into our lane and we dig our heads down and we don't, you know, talk about what's happening, then we're just not going to be able to put the spotlight on anything. And I'm not talking about us specifically, but like, just imagine if LeBron or Chris Paul just put their heads down and just dribbled, as was it Laura Ingraham who said that? The devil's spawn. I think it's, you know, that would just be counterintuitive to everything. It would just be counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve as a global community. I mean, we all are citizens of the world, and I realize that sounds cliche as hell, but it's still true. And that means that we have a responsibility to improve and help each other and help ourselves and make sure that all of us gets along. And this is just not the way to do it. And that is why that we're seeing the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, have such momentum, because it's relevant and it's real, and it's not some, as some people would like to point out or blame the masses being like this fake sort of, you know, movement. It's truly not. It's the exact opposite. And I think now more than ever, we're seeing all the consequences, you know, that's coming from having ignored racial rights for so long. It's it's everything's deplorable, and 2020 sucks. And now you're going to be following this up with yet another bad piece of news, because this is how we're going to be starting podcasts in 2020 again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will just say, you know, on the stick to sports or shut up and dribble note, this isn't a political issue. It's not a Democrat issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's not whatever party you are. Saying an unarmed black man should not be shot by police is not, it's not political. This is just, every human has the right not to be gunned down in the middle of the street. And if you if you think it is political, pull your head out of your ass. Like,
but Brian, he was resisting arrest. Oh yeah, that's why he got 7 bullets in the back. Yeah, that's, oh God.
Yeah, and on a personal note, I just want to wish the best to all of my colleagues at Bleacher Report who were let go yesterday. We suffered a number of notable losses, and our brand will, we're going to miss them a lot. You know, Howard Beck is among the names who you've seen on Twitter, and I don't want to get into the full list of them. You can find their names on, you know, Awful Announcing or Front Office Sports or whatever. But I wish them nothing but the best. They were some of the best that Bleacher Report had to offer, and I'm sure they're all going to go on to do great things elsewhere, and you should continue to follow their work. And I would really just encourage, as a sports community, we all need to be better about sharing the types of content that we want to see more of, because this is ultimately, it's a results-based business. You know, if a piece clicks well and you are run by an ad-based model, that's what the media company is going to continue producing. So, you know, we do a ton of mock drafts and redrafts and trade speculation. We'll get into that in this episode too, and it's fun. You know, I get it, but if you want to continue to see good journalism, access journalism, features, you know, long form stories about where athletes have come from and how they've gotten to the point that they are now, we all need to support that work however we can.
Yes.
Or else we're going to get, you know, at 10 Joel Embiid trade ideas every day from now until the end of time.
Right. Right. That's, preaching to the choir. It's, it's a tough day, and it's not just Bleacher Report. Like, he recently, you know, The Athletic had to let a lot of people go as well. It's a very, very difficult business to be in, for sure. And ultimately, I think it comes down to, like, I think you touched on it, and I realize we're taking a lot of time of your time, listeners out there, but really this is important. So I was about to apologize, but I'm actually not gonna, because this is important. You know, you and I, Brian, we know, and we talk about this all the time off air, there are a lot of people in the industry who are gaining, you know, quick fame and a lot of money by being these, you know, characters on TV or on our social platforms, who are basically putting on a false face and saying a lot of, you know, dumb stuff that they don't even believe themselves, mm-hmm. because they're playing a character. And they do so because they know that it's going to get hits. They know it's going to get clicks. I mean, Kendrick Perkins, and I'm going to say his name here, is because I think he's the perfect example of this. And I hate actually saying his name because I don't want people to go into his Twitter account based off my mentioning him and follow him, because I think what he's doing is hurting sports writing and sports commentating and basically sports in general, because this is a man who tailors his own, you know, views to what the debate is around social media. Like, he's flip-flopping like he's Flipper, and he's just saying a bunch of weird stuff all the time because he knows that there's a lot of attention in that. Like, he's picking fights with players. Do you think that is just unintentional? No, that is mapped out to the fullest scope. Absolutely it is. And it is taking jobs away from everyone else, because if people are too focused on the hot takey one-sentence tweets or one-sentence articles, more or less, or reaggregation articles, or, you know, it's not helping the everyday man. And I'm not sitting here saying, oh, well, that's because we're writing, so you should help us. No, I'm saying that we have a very, very awesome pool of writers and content creators who, you know, kick my ass every single day and twice on Sundays. So it's, you know, go out there and support them. It's definitely important, and it's important to also not support, you know, the hot takers like Skip Bayless or Kendrick Perkins. Just mute them, put them on block, don't give them the satisfaction. And I realize that what I'm essentially saying is don't give them a paycheck. But that's not how it should be interpreted. It should be interpreted as such that if you want proper journalism, then find it with proper journalists or proper bloggers who actually know what they're talking about. Just if you want something good, find the people who provide the good.
Yeah. Like, you don't have to dunk on every stupid Kendrick Perkins tweet because you're only just feeding the beast. Like, instead, rather than dunking on it and getting retweets and likes or whatever, share a good Mirren Fader piece, because I promise you will learn something from every single piece you read of hers.
Brian, by the way, we have not had Mirren on.
Yeah, that will be rectified in short order. I'm going to...
Jesus, what the hell were we thinking?
Well, especially because she wrote, if anyone out there has not read it, she wrote possibly the best feature about LaMelo Ball. She went over there and, you know, spent, I think, weeks over there, you know, kind of just diving into the phenomenon that is LaMelo Ball. So we'll try to get her on before the draft so we can really go deep with her. But on a brighter note, Mort, let's talk about the Philadelphia 76ers.
oh my god.
Where to even begin with
Well, I know where to begin. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know where we'll begin, because I'm just going to do this, and that's just doing nothing, but I've now magically erased our curse filter for this episode. So I'm just going to push my chair away from the computer. And I'm going to sit down in a very, very intense, focused position, and I'm just going to let you go for 20 goddamn minutes.
Well, I mean, I really want to start with this. I mean, obviously, they get swept out on Sunday. They fire Brett Brown Monday. It sounds like Ty Lue is atop their list of coaching candidates based on multiple reports. Chris Mannix of Sports Illustrated, Shams Charania of The Athletic, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. All mentioned Ty Lue. I think Woj called him the focus of their search. Mannix said there's expected to be mutual interest. Mort, do you think Lue is the right option for the Sixers, or is there someone else out there that they should be considering as well?
I don't care, because I think everything needs to be blown to bits. No, that's where I am.
Good start. Yeah.
So I, full disclosure, I went on a Danish podcast for TV2, where I work right now, where this subject came up, and we were talking about it, and I just this is what I feel strongly about, and I'm going to stick to it. I think the 76ers just need to be blown up for several reasons that I can come into later. But because I have that opinion, I don't think who the coach is right now is in any way, shape, or form important. Because if you're going to get Ty Lue, I have to assume it's because of the pedigree with him having juggled multiple stars in Cleveland, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And my point is blow it all sky high to hell. So it that need is now out of the window.
That is fair. I mean, I'm approaching this, you know, Elton Brand spoke with reporters earlier this morning, so I sat in on his press conference. He did say he has no intention of trading Ben or Joel right now. He, you know, repeatedly brought up their age, said the 24 and 26. They want to be here for a long time. He's going to consult them with regard to decisions this offseason, both coaching and roster. You know, he's basically saying, I want to talk to them, find out what they think worked well, what we need to fix, and then move about our offseason accordingly. So it does not sound like the Sixers this offseason are going to seriously entertain a Simmons or Embiid trade. You know, if someone calls them up with an absolutely like blockbuster offer, I don't think that necessarily precludes them, but I don't think they are actively shopping either guy.
Well, you and I have different perspective of what a good offer is, though.
Yeah. Well, and we'll get into that shortly. But just on the Lue note, I mean, I think you're right that it's the, you know, obviously, A, he won a championship, went to three straight NBA finals with the Cavs. But it is the respect that he had with LeBron and Kyrie in particular. You know, after Sunday's game, Josh Richardson spoke in the locker room and, you know, very plainly said accountability, a lack of accountability was one of our biggest issues this year. And this was not the first time he had said this. And, you know, for those of you out there who read Yaron Weitzman's book or even listened to the pod with him, you know, we touched on that. Like, this is not the first time that we've heard that Brown struggled to hold, especially it sounds like Embiid and Simmons accountable. You know, we see the right glaring example where, you know, Ben hits that three early in the season. Brett says, great, I wanted to see you take a three every single night. He doesn't take one for like the next 30 games. You know, and I think that's probably what Josh was alluding to. I mean, ultimately, I think a lot of the issues comes for the Sixers in general come down to Ben Simmons' refusal to take a jump shot, Joel Embiid's conditioning, and his passing. And if either of those guys fix those flaws, that may be able to paper over a lot of the issues that popped up this year. But they're going to need someone to push them to fix those flaws and to not have this outcome repeat over and over again.
I hate beating a dead horse. I really do. But there was this one guy who liked to push people.
Yeah.
And there was this center that we just talked about. I think his name is Joel Embiid, who actually liked playing with that guy who pushed people a whole lot.
Yep.
And it's funny how the presence of that one player actually allowed this Joel Embiid to have the best season of his career simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
That's, wow, this is obviously crazy, but it's almost like personalities matter. Huh?
Yeah.
Isn't that like just a weird thing?
Well, I think this year in particular was probably weird, and I bet a lot of the guys were kind of walking on eggshells trying to figure out where they fit in the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Because you had such drastic offseason changes, because for Josh and Al and even Tobias, who, you know, came in last February, they're new to the organization. They know clearly Joel and Ben are the two centerpieces. So, you know, can you take that vocal leadership role knowing that, you know, the organization does not prioritize you over those two guys? And I think with Tobias, especially in the last few months, we've seen that he was more willing to be a vocal leader and, you know, good for team chemistry. A lot of the guys were saying that throughout the bubble experience, obviously had a very rough series against the Celtics, but
right.
you know, like, seems like a genuinely just good guy off the court. And I think you do need that. And I think the same is true for Al Horford. Like, Tobias and Al Horford are going to get destroyed on Sixers Twitter, and they have all year, because relative to their contract, they are underperforming. And because they are on such big contracts, and we'll touch on their trade value in a second here, it's going to be really hard to rejigger the roster. Like, they have two of the worst contracts in the NBA. So right. they're going to be blamed for a lot of this stuff, even though, like, no one forced the Sixers to trade for Tobias Harris and to give him $180 million. No one forced the Sixers to go out and sign Al Horford to a $109 million deal. It sucks in that regard, but like, Al Horford seems like a genuinely good dude too, and like, I don't think he came to the Sixers last summer thinking like, I'm just gonna steal $109 million from Josh Harris and just totally suck and not fit next to Ben and Joel and ha ha ha, I'm the Celtics plant saboteur or whatever. Like, he wants to make this thing work. It's just, you know, they built a roster for the mid-2000s instead of the 2020s.
Yeah, I'm just gonna let you go. Okay. If you have a question for me, just ask it. But I'm just gonna let you go because I'm loving this. Just dig in, okay. Dig in. Yeah, again, the curse filter is still lifted, Brian.
So I mean, obviously, like they're saying it will hit Ben and Joel in a second, but they're saying they're not gonna try to trade them this offseason. And I think they were pretty transparent. They're going to do everything in their power not to trade one of those guys. They want to give a new coach a chance to see if they can figure out a better fit. They're going to try to retailer the roster around these guys. How do you trade Tobias Harris or Al Horford this offseason? Do you think there is a team out there that genuinely would have interest in one of those two guys? How much would you if you're the Sixers, how much do you have to attach to dump one of those two contracts?
No, you have to probably dump a little bit or attach a little bit more to dump Horford just because of age. So I want to talk about Tobias Harris first on this because I think we've reached that point where Tobias Harris, because of his contract, went from being initially overrated, obviously because of that contract, to now being significantly underrated as a player. And I'm saying that fully knowing he had a rough series. Mm-hmm. But he is genuinely a good player. He is a very, very good player. Like, he had like a year this year, he averaged 27-3. If he became just a little bit more of a sniper from range, oh my God, like, he would be so good. And I think there are teams out there that know that he is so close to becoming, you know, an all-star, which I don't think he's been yet, right? No, he hasn't made the all-star team yet. But I think there's a team out there that's kind of saying, you know what, he's right there. He's 28, like, he's in his prime. Then he could be an all-star like from next year and a couple years of forward. So maybe let's gamble on him. That one, I wouldn't be surprised if Philly actually succeeded in trading him without having to attach too many assets. Like, if you may attach, I don't know, Matisse Thybulle. I realized that for Sixers Twitter, I just gave them a heart attack. But you cannot expect just to, like, some protected second rounder. That's just not realistic. Yeah. But if you say Matisse Thybulle and Tobias Harris to, like, Atlanta for a protected second, so you basically just dump him,
mm-hmm.
they would take that immediately, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the problem from the Sixers' perspective, I think, is what is cap... Like, if you're dumping him just for cap relief... What is cap relief going to get you?
Oh, nowhere.
Right. So you're just making yourself markedly worse, both in the short term and the long term, because you're still stuck with three big contracts. Like, you're not going to be able to add. It's not like you can go dump Tobias Harris and then add a $30 million player. That's
right.
Not how it works. And if you somehow then manage to dump Al Horford, then you'll have a little bit of financial flexibility, and then you could. But you have to get rid of both of these guys. So... You know, I've seen Sixers Twitter, of course, is running with a ton of Tobias and Al trade ideas, and I just think it's going to be harder to trade either of those guys than a lot of people on Sixers Twitter seem to believe. I hope I'm wrong.
It'd have to be a dump, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, and it only takes one team, you know? Like, if the New York Knicks get desperate to bring in any semblance of a star, and they just say, you know, take some of these, whatever, the two-year deal things that we signed last summer, like, take Alfred Payton and Bobby Portis, like, okay, I think the Sixers would probably do that. But you know, I saw one of the most popular ideas is some construct of, like, Al Horford for Buddy Hield. That is not going to happen. Not without significant...
So how many draft picks
right.
would Philadelphia attach to that?
Right, right. And I think if you're a team trading with Philly, you don't want their 2021 pick. You want to go out, like, 2023, 2024. Like, you want to bank on one of Embiid or Simmons leaving. And then them getting very bad.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, it would not shock me. I think they're going to explore the trade market, obviously, for these guys. But especially given the coronavirus pandemic and the effect on the salary cap, like, if the cap stays flat, there aren't that many teams with cap room to accept a salary dump in the first place. A lot of teams could be looking to dump contracts to get under the tax. So, like, there may be a lot of competition for salary dumps. And, you know, if you're a team, if you're in Atlanta, for instance, like, do you want a one-year deal with one pick attached, or do you want a four-year deal with 35-plus million for, with two or three picks attached? You probably just say, I'll punt the 1 year of cap space. Who cares? But, like, taking on a Tobias Harris or an Al Horford locks you in for a lot longer. So
right.
I am skeptical of their ability to trade either player. We'll see what happens. But what you mentioned, you know, you're at the point you think we should be talking about bigger changes, Simmons and Embiid.
Right. Both. So here's my logic. I like Embiid the best because I think he's just flat out the better player.
Mm-hmm.
But we just can't get around certain things. And I've brought this up, I guess, since he actually started playing, right? That he's not a guy who shoots a high percentage?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you build around that? He's right. A center, and he should be a traditional center. So today, on the Danish podcast that I did, I actually dug up some numbers, which I found interesting. So obviously, when he's, like, very, very close to the rim, he's elite. Like, mm-hmm. this year, he shot 72.5% from within 3 feet. Like, that's great. That's an elite level of offensive production. The drop-off comes already in the next segment, which is 3 to 10 feet away from the rim. He drops to 46.8% from the field. And then it just flattens out from there. It just gets worse and worse and worse the more away from the basket he goes.
Mm-hmm.
Look, you just can't build around that in today's NBA. I realize that you know, he's great defensively. He's a great rebounder, so those things aren't forgotten. But you can't build around that. It's just, it is going to build an offense that is way too predictable because it's going to be a post-centric offense. Now, if I don't think this is feasible by any chance. Like, if you put Joel Embiid on the Warriors and he played alongside Steph, Klay, and Draymond, sure. Because that's a whole different dynamic right there. He wouldn't right. be the first option. So right. so the post option would be a complementary option. But if you build an entire team around him, which you would have to do, I just wonder if that's good enough. We've already seen, like, the post player and forced shooters all the way, you know, back in 2009 with Dwight
yeah.
under Stan Van Gundy. That, yeah, sure, it made the finals, but that was in 2009.
right.
It doesn't work that same level. And now you're seeing centers who are taking seven or eight three-pointers a game. That's just a necessity. And Joel has taken that shot, but he's done it out of necessity because he actually is waiting for Ben to get that shot off, which he isn't. Yeah. So I just think it's if you trade Ben Simmons and you stick with Joel Embiid, you're going to run into a very, very hard ceiling in terms of how high you can go as a team. Because I have to assume if you keep Joel Embiid, you are working under the assumption he is going to be the best that you have. And I'm sorry to say, even though I love Joel Embiid, he's just not good enough.
Yeah.
Moving on to Ben Simmons afterwards. Yeah, let me have it. Yell at
me. No, I think you're right. And I would encourage anyone who has a subscription to The Athletic, or if you don't, go subscribe because they have a lot of great people writing for them. Seth Partnow had a really good column yesterday about, like, you know, the notion of can you build a, or like, is he good enough to win? And the conclusion was yes, with the right supporting cast, but he basically needs an elite wing next to him. He is not on the tier of LeBron, of Giannis, of even Luka. Like, you need a guy who can create off the dribble next to him. You can't, you are right. You cannot run an offense through him, because we saw what happened in that Celtics series. He averaged like 30 and 10 in that series. Like, he put up the numbers, and, you know, that's not a huge surprise, but the Celtics predictably double teamed him. He predictably did not have a counter, which is an issue that he, like, you know, if you're talking about the three things that Joel Embiid needs to work on more than anything else, one, conditioning, always. That's just always going to be the most important thing for him, just so he can stay healthy and get through a full 82-game season, or however long the next season's going to be. Two, the passing, especially out of double teams, or passing out of the post in general. And then three, you mentioned it, the shot selection, it's like almost Russell Westbrook-esque, where if you just cut out like the three or four worst shot attempts he takes per game and put them in more efficient areas, he would be a much better player. And, you know, I'm not saying he should never take threes. I don't think that's true. I think he, especially until Ben starts shooting him, he needs to. But it's the pull up with 18 seconds left on the shot clock. Those threes can go. Like, if you are, if it's a catch and shoot and you're trailing in transition, go for it. All for it. You're wide open. If you are dribbling, and then trying a step back three like James Harden, absolutely not. No way. And you should get pulled. Like, he should be pulled from the game when he does stupid stuff like that. And that goes back to the accountability thing that we'll see what happens with their coach. But yeah, so I'm actually with you. Like, ultimately, moving forward, I think we've reached a point where, unless they are somehow able to dump Tobias or Al Horford, they won't do it this offseason. But by next offseason, if they don't substantially improve, I think they're probably going to have to seriously consider trading Joel Embiid, because at that point he's only going to have 2 years left on his contract.
Right.
He checked out this year. He said it. He went on JJ Redick's podcast and said he was not all there. Like, he let the offseason changes get to him, and he just didn't give his full effort, which you could see on a night-to-night basis. It was very obvious. So I do think we're rapidly approaching a point where the Sixers are going to have to choose between one or the other, and it's not because they couldn't win together. It's because they did such a terrible job building around them that now that this might be their only way out.
So I wasn't going to share this. Over the weekend, I was working for, you know, CV2, the place that I write, but as I was actually in the control room covering live games over the weekend, four games, one of them being, you know, the final game for the 76ers. And when you're sitting in a control room, you have a lot of monitors, a lot, because we're getting the feed from the US, and we're getting a lot of different angles. We're getting a ton of footage. And, you know, I was sitting there talking to one of the guys who controlled the whole poll there, and he was like, throughout the entire game, just, man, look at what Joel Embiid is doing, or rather not doing. Like, why is he doing this? Why isn't he doing that? And during a break, we just started scrolling through the game, because you can do that really quickly when you're sitting in a professional control room. Mm-hmm. And within just a few minutes, he more or less had a package ready of Joel Embiid's, what's the kind word to say, slip-ups?
Shacked into fools.
More or less, just him, or him just being disengaged,
yeah,
him taking a bad shot, him having bad body language. And, you know, to me, that was just, that was so wild to see how quickly, you know, you could just sum up that, you know, that performance, because he just, like, he was gone. His mind was not on the game after halftime. I want to say it was just, he was completely checked out. Yeah. And the reason it caught my eye was not, oh, this is unusual. It was, he did it again, but under, you know, dire circumstances. You know, your team is behind, you know, 0-3, and you're just already at that point where you're going, well, this is it. I understand that the numbers work against you. Like, no team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit. So I understand, like, the logic in saying, well, okay, I would have to basically lead an historic turnaround for this to happen. But you know what? Most of the truly great ones, they believe that. Mm-hmm. They believe that all the way through. That's why they're great. Even though they never succeed in doing it, that's why they come out like gangbusters in the later games as well. And for him to just basically say, nope, I'm just done. Like, I'm jacking up dumb shots. And the one thing was, he had, you remember this one, he had Kempa on a switch.
Yeah.
And he backed him down to, like, the three-throw area. And I remember we were sitting in the booth, and one of the guys said, you know, this is going to be a jam, because obviously, right, cookies. And he took a fadeaway. Like, he backed him down, gave him a little shove, and took a fadeaway jumper from around the free throw line. That was, to me, just the clearest sign ever that Joel Embiid was in body preservation mode for that game.
Yep.
And basically just saying, we're done, so I'm not going to get injured. I'm just going to take these, you know, shots that I just have no chance of getting injured on, and then I'm going to go into the off season.
Yeah.
That matters as well. That is also something that I think needs to be accounted for. Is does he have the right mentality to be a number one guy day in and day out? He might if he had the same, you know, reliable co-stars, but right. He doesn't.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's ultimately, like, and I said this in my piece on Forbes, like, they, if they are going to accomplish the goals that they hope to still accomplish, they need Joel Embiid to be locked in on both ends of the floor from opening tip last year. Like, this year he said he was going to try to preserve himself a little bit because he'd been frustrated that he hadn't been healthy entering the playoffs. Now we saw, I mean, ultimately, like, losing Ben Simmons in that series in particular made it an uphill battle regardless, but, you know, now we saw he was healthy in the playoffs and they still aren't good enough. So that, like, it's possible that they've reached the point of no return. I am somehow both skeptical about the Tobias and Al trades, but also believe with the right tertiary moves this offseason, they might not be as far away as they looked in that Celtics series, but it's clear they have a lot of work to do this offseason.
Well, and far away from what, though?
Being a legitimate factor in the East again.
I'm sorry, but I think you're just lying to yourself.
It's possible. I just think, like, they have to at least try something else before giving up completely. And if
is it giving up completely if you trade your two guys, if you just realize that that's not going to work and both of them have tremendous flaw individually and collectively they don't work? Is that giving up, or is it just pivoting into a new direction?
I think it would be giving up if you don't give a new coach a chance.
Okay.
Like, let's see if it's Ty Lue or whoever it is, bring that person in, see if they can get through to them the way that Brett could not. And if he can't, then you start to seriously consider, okay, maybe it's not the coach, maybe it's them.
Right. So, just to wrap up my thing with the players, because you mentioned, like, trading both. Here's why I also wouldn't build around Ben. Because I think you and I agree that if you are to build around Ben, you pretty much have to apply the same logic filter as the Bucks did with Giannis, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, you have surround him with shooters and, you know, players who can get their shots off. All right. Great. The problem is, you're doing that with Giannis in Milwaukee, and that's great and all, but Ben Simmons is not Giannis, nor will he ever be Giannis.
Right.
So I'm sitting here thinking, if you apply that logic and you try to build it that way, okay, cool, you're setting yourself up to be, at max, a second-round team that's going to get busted. Because if your top-tier guy on that team is Ben Simmons, you're just not going to go anywhere. So basically what I'm saying is this. Neither guy is a true to form, you know, tier A, top level, top notch superstar. Like there isn't that Giannis Antetokounmpo right there. Both of them are just that level below. And unfortunately, as the NBA is built, you need that one top tier guy.
Yeah, well, this will not be the last time we talk about the Sixers this offseason, but I want to hit
really?
The
case. Really? I am very surprised.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they have a big offseason ahead of them now. But I want to hit the Pacers, too, because I think...
Are we done? Did I lift the curse filter for you to just not utilize it? Come on, man.
No, I'm too broken inside to care about the Sixers right now, honestly.
I had people contacting me, man, saying, I'm so looking forward to this podcast. Brian is going to go apeshit. And you're just like this beaten down old man. Okay. Well, you know what? I guess that is a pretty strong sign of where the Sixers are.
Yeah. Well, I think the Pacers are in an equally interesting spot. Obviously, they were not full strength, much like the Sixers against Boston. So it is hard to evaluate them. You know, would they have been swept had Sabonis been healthy and playing? Probably not. Are they good enough even with Sabonis in the mix and with Jeremy Lamb in the mix to genuinely contend for a title, to beat Milwaukee, beat Boston, beat Toronto, beat Miami? Probably not. So where do they go from here, Mort? Like, I think the first question, you know, we'll hit Turner and Sabonis in a second because that's the constant refrain with them. But we need to start with Oladipo because he will now be entering the final year of his contract. He's an unrestricted free agent after the 2020-2021 season. So what do you do if you're Indiana with Victor Oladipo?
Oh, boy. You know, that's a tough one because on one hand, and I've brought this up before, he had that one great season for them.
Yeah,
in 2017-2018. But it seems, unfortunately, that was the outlier. Because all the, you know, his play ever since, even before he went down last season, you know, it wasn't up to standard. It was more so much of the same even before he hit Indiana. So I suspect and I fear, rather, that Victor Oladipo's one-year superstardom was just that. And in that case, like, what do you do? Where do you go from here with him? Do you trust that he's going to return to this level? Or do you cut bait? I think Depo is just, he's such a good guy as well. Like, that matters. Like, he's offering a lot of positives in the locker room. Everyone speaks very, very highly of him. And that stuff matters. So this is not me basically saying, oh, he's not good enough, get him out of the way. Because having a positive influence in the locker room, and he's still a good player, obviously. He just may not be the superstar that the Pacers were hoping that he was becoming. You know, you would want to return that guy, but at a salary that doesn't reflect superstardom. And I think that's the key. You have to sit down with him and his agent and figure out a contract that works for both sides. If you can't, then it's time, I think, unfortunately, to just kind of cut bait. Even though I wouldn't want that necessarily, but is he that guy? That's the biggest question. I still have that question. It's like 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that is the number one question, more than the Turner Sabonis thing hanging over the Pacers right now. They have the opportunity to offer him an extension, and maybe with the injury uncertainty hanging over him, and also again the financial uncertainty from the COVID stuff, maybe he's willing to take less than a max extension, but probably not. I mean, the most they can offer him, it's a 20% raise, so he'd be starting at $25.2 million, which is well short of the $32.7 million that he could earn, and they'll probably be even higher next year. So, you know, in all likelihood, he's going to gamble on himself. And then the question becomes, okay, well, if you're Indiana, do you, you know, gamble on this core for one more year and then run the risk of losing him for nothing next offseason? Or do you shop him around now and see what you can get? You know, Miami has been mentioned as being potentially interested in him, either as a free agent target or trade target. You would assume that they're going to save cap space to make a run at Giannis in 2021 if he does not sign a Supermax extension this offseason.
Right.
If he does, I mean, I've been kind of wondering this. Like, Miami's got somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million in space. We'll see exactly how much it is once they figure out what the cap is. You know, if Giannis signs that Supermax, I would not be surprised to see Miami pivot. And I guess the question from that perspective is, like, is Oladipo the right guy to pivot toward if you're Miami? Like, is he the missing ingredient next to Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo? That I'm more skeptical of.
He would have been if this was 17-18.
Yeah, even then. I mean, that's not to say anything about Victor Oladipo. Like, he's a great player.
Right.
But because Jimmy and Bam are such non-shooters, I really don't know if Oladipo, like, he hit 37% was his career high, 37.1% in that All-Star season. I don't know if that's good enough. Like, I worry about spacing, even with, you know, Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero, Goran Dragic. Like, if you have Oladipo, Butler, and Bam on the court all at one time.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, spacing seems like it might become an issue there. But defensively, they'd be incredible. So maybe it doesn't matter.
I mean, defense would definitely be number one, but I just don't think it hurts adding, you know, the 2017-2018 version, who's a 23-point scorer to that roster, because he was wonderful at just getting his own shot off and he could cut off the ball and all that. I think for him, it's just a matter of when is it projected for him to get his fluidity back, because he doesn't look like the same player visually.
Right.
I mean, he still looks very, very hindered. It doesn't seem like he's getting the same lift on his jump shot. It still seems like he's just kind of playing catch up, and it's been a long while now. And I'm not blaming him whatsoever. That injury was horrific, absolutely horrific. So I'm not gonna sit here and pretend like, oh, that's get up, young fella. It's fine. It's but a flesh wound. No, like that was legitimate. But it just alters futures, right? Every injury alters future. Like, if Derrick Rose, like,
right,
completely changed the fabric of the Bulls moving forward after his ACL tear.
Yep.
And that's just the reality of the business that we cover. So Indiana needs to be, they need to be a little bit selfish here. They need to make sure that their, you know, their interests are safe, I think. And it sounds harsh, but they're a small market.
Yeah.
If they lock Oladipo up on a large contract, and he just disappears into Nicholas Batum country, then what?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. Like, if I'm the Pacers, I don't want to say I'm aggressively shopping Victor Oladipo this offseason, but I'm definitely reaching out and seeing what's out there for him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I you know, I would be much more reluctant to trade Ben Simmons or Joel Embiid than I would be to trade Victor Oladipo this offseason. Just because of where they are with their contractual status.
Look, man, when I'm calling teams about Victor Oladipo, I'm even gonna throw in the fact that he's a fantastic singer.
That's true, yeah. That should boost his trade value.
Right? I'm gonna do everything I can to boost up that trade value for him. Like, even if it's just a little bit, I'm gonna do it, because you need to have a deal in your back pocket, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I ultimately, fundamentally, do you believe this team is currently constructed can win a championship?
No. Yeah. I think they can tease teams. I think they can give certain teams a hard time when they're fully healthy. And again, assuming Depo is back to full health. But no, I don't think they can, you know, get to the finals.
Right.
No, of course not. I think this is a team that could give Eastern Conference team hell in two rounds or so, but that's it. So, you know, it depends. If you're the Pacers, what do you want to do? Are you satisfied being a second round team ultimately, you know, when everything is optimized, or do you want to go for the whole shebang? Because, you know, this is the thing that we talk about so very often on this podcast, and which is the global narrative coming around the NBA. If you're not good enough, do you keep going with that core, or do you just basically blow it to bits and start over and build through the draft?
Right. Right. And I don't know that they necessarily need to. I don't even think they can totally blow it up. I mean, they have.
No, and they shouldn't.
Right. They have enough good players. Even if you trade Victor Oladipo, it's not like you're going to get nothing back for him. You know, like,
right,
you'll still have Brogdon and TJ Warren and Sabonis, Lamb, if he, you know, when he recovers from the injury. So, like, they have a lot of stuff in the cupboard, and they, frankly, they have a lot of, they don't have any, like, egregiously bad contract on the books. They have a lot of guys making that, like, mid-tier money where they have a lot of flexibility. Like, they aren't, I agree with you right now, they are not a championship contending roster, but they have the potential to get there if they make the right moves from here on out. But they're at the kind of the trickiest part of team building, where, you know, you've gotten from, I don't even want to say like good to great, but like, you know, you're in that mix, you're in the top six of the East mix, but how do you get to the top three? And, you know, whether it's an Oladipo trade or whether it's breaking up Warren or Turner or Sabonis, it's going to be really tricky from here on out.
Yeah. I think teams that lock themselves into a certain core where you don't have that top tier number one guy, this is going to be the question hanging over them until they either rebuild or they trade someone, right?
Yeah.
Because you're just putting yourself up, not to failure, because making the second round of the playoffs isn't failure, but you're never really going to exceed that unless everything breaks your way, that every one of your opponents are going through significant injuries, for example.
Right.
And I just don't think that's the way you build a team. I mean, you need that one tier guy. But again, there are like five guys in the NBA who fits that like tier one criteria. Like, it's ridiculously low. So again, you have to do the best of what you can. But man, what they just locked up everyone, right? They just locked up an entire team. Like, Victor Oladipo is locked up with 20 plus million. Brock, 20 plus million. Miles Turner, 18 million. CJ is on a good deal. 11.7 next year. Jeremy Lamb, 10.5. Doug McDermott, 7. And then Sabonis' contract kicks in, and that's actually not egregious. Like, 17 million starting next year. That's not bad for Sabonis. Like, mm-hmm. it's fine. But, I mean, it's still just, it's a lot of money tied up to a team that, would you be shocked if they didn't make the playoffs?
Next year?
No, but I'm just saying, like, over the span of those contracts, even if they're all healthy, like, they could have a down year. I wouldn't even be surprised if they missed the playoffs. I don't necessarily think they would. I'm just saying, you know, this is one of those teams that could go a little bit either way. Whereas if you're Boston, for example, and you know that your main guys are healthy, it's a surefire thing. They're a playoff team. They're a definitive playoff team. No, you know, ifs and buts about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of it, the Turner Sabonis thing will be an issue until they inevitably break one of, or trade one of them. I think at this point it is very clear that they will prefer Sabonis over Turner. I just had the thought of getting Turner to Golden State, because I'm thinking, like, which teams need centers? And I've been, you know, dancing around the idea of, like, Al Horford trades and Embiid trades. And part of the issue is a lot of teams don't need centers now. Like, a lot of teams are pretty set, or if they aren't, they don't want to be spending, as you've been alluding to. They don't want to be spending 18, 20, 25 million on a center when, you know, you can find replacement level value at the room mid level, like $5 million. But yeah, the Warriors are one that I just thought of, but I think his contract is like less than a million more than that Iguodala trade exception. So now I'm sad, because he actually could be really fun there.
Oh, yeah. The trade exception is 17 and Turner's 18.
Yeah. But like that's one of the rare places. Like, at this point, we've talked about him enough. Like, the ship has sailed on him becoming a 20-point-per-game scorer. It's not going to happen. Like, good defensive player, great shot blocker. That's, you know, good complementary scorer, not going to create for himself. He's developing three-point range, which is great. You know, and he's still really young. He's only 24, so there's time for him. But, you know,
and he's really good at yoga.
There you go. I guess, like, Dallas could be an option.
Nope.
Houston, maybe, if they
pivot back.
Yeah, if they decide, actually, we do need a center. Or New Orleans, actually. Next to Zion. New Orleans
would be interesting. Just don't put that evil on Dallas, baby.
That's fair.
Remember, Dallas is my team now. I've sort of switched allegiance here, so don't. I've been frustrated enough with Miles Turner. If I'm going to see him play every single game next to Luka, don't make me sad. I'll be very frustrated.
That's fair. What about Miami, actually? Next to Bam.
Okay. All right. So, on a theoretical scale, that does sound intriguing. But this is when we have to remember who's on the Miami Heat, though.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Will Jimmy Butler just? I was about to say pound his ass, but that came out
like destroy
really
him.
Wrong.
Just
you know
totally,
what I mean?
Yeah.
Just
break him.
Completely annihilate him. Yeah. I think he might, because what Jimmy hates more than anything is the fact that you have a certain skill level and you're just not living up to it because you don't work hard enough, or you're not just trying to put that skill level to the test.
Yeah.
And Turner is so much better than what his stats indicate, or rather should be so much better than what his numbers indicate. And he's not doing it. Like he's just settling all the time. He could be so good and he's not. So Jimmy would probably just destroy his confidence level, you know, within 2 weeks.
Yeah. That is very true. Well, yeah, I mean, look, the Sixers are going to suck up a ton of airspace this offseason just because of the scope of their changes, but the Pacers are facing a similarly really important offseason, and I'm almost equally fascinated to see how they navigate these changes.
Right.
So, Moit, let's pivot now to stop talking about bad Eastern Conference teams that we don't have to watch anymore, thankfully. We have Boston Celtics, Toronto Raptors on tap starting Thursday. That is going to be possibly one of the best series in the playoffs, I think. What are the specific things you're keeping an eye on in this series?
Jason Tatum is one, because he's now going to go up against a real test.
Yep.
I'm sorry. That sounded harsh for Philly fans, but yeah.
I mean,
Toronto has...
Sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say, like, the Sixers were down two of their top wing options. Like, going against OG Anunoby and Pascal Siakam is a massive upgrade from Tobias Harris.
Right, exactly. And not just those guys. Hell, even Kyle Lowry. Because you know what? That little nugget is not giving up one single inch of space.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who is, like, he guards. He is just so steadfast, and like when someone goes into the post against him, they're like, oh yeah, barbecue chicken, and it's like, uh-oh, no, I'm getting roasted, because he's not giving up a damn thing, and if he is, it's him taking a charge. The Raptors just have so many great weapons, defensive weapons at their disposal to not take care of Jason Tatum, because I think Jason Tatum is entering that airspace now where you can't shut him down,
mm-hmm.
but they are going to make him work so bad. And that means more possessions, presumably, for Jaylen Brown,
mm-hmm.
which I think is interesting. Because if there's something that's been kept a little bit under wraps this year, which I know many, many Celtics fans, or all of Celtics Twitter knows this, and they've been shouting into the void about it, but no one has really listened, even though they're completely right. Jaylen Brown has learned to dribble, and effectively so. Like, he's begun having, you know, significantly more shake and bake in his game. There is a creative dribble package that's been installed in his software over this last summer. And that could be very, very interesting for the Celtics if the Raptors key in on Tatum and kind of like force the ball to Brown, because I would suspect that Brown is going to turn some heads.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's Tatum Brown versus OG and Pascal is just going to be fascinating on both ends. Because I would assume, if I had to guess matchup wise, I'm guessing OG guards Tatum, Pascal guards Jaylen. And then on the other end, I would guess it'll be the inverse, Jaylen on Pascal, Tatum presumably on OG, I guess.
To save him, yes.
Yeah, because I guess Smart... I mean, the Hayward injury really looms large here, because that's just one fewer wing for the Raptors to have to worry about in that starting lineup. And now they actually match up a little bit better with Smart in the lineup, because I'm guessing it could be, you know, hell, I mean, they'll switch all the time, but like Lowry and Fred VanVleet on Kemba and Smart is a lot better than, okay, which one of these guys is guarding Gordon Hayward and giving up a ton of size. So
I mean, I agree with that.
We'll see. I don't anticipate we'll see Gordon Hayward in this series at all. And that could end up swinging things. Whereas, you know, like heading into this thing, I thought it looking ahead, I was thinking like Boston over Toronto. Now I'm genuinely really torn here.
Oh, I'm not. I'm actually going to sit this one out in terms of predictions.
Yeah,
like I'm not going down that path. This is too just. This is even for me completely. I'm just hoping this goes seven, because this could be a tremendously fun series.
Yeah, I mean it's two. They're both. I guess the Raptors aren't like elite offensively, but like two definitely elite defenses. And the Celtics are elite offensively, and I think the Raptors have the personnel to match up very well against them and really gum up a lot of the stuff that they have going well for them. The benches are the one area where it's just totally lopsided, especially with Hayward out. Toronto has a massive advantage when we're talking about depth. And especially if this series does go long, that could start to be a factor in games 4, 5, 6, 7 if, you know, both teams are, or if Boston is being forced to play Tatum, Brown, Kemba, Smart, you know, upwards of 40 minutes a game, do they start to get fatigued like we're seeing with the Blazers in this series right now against the Lakers?
That's a good point. I don't think they really have anyone. You would hope for some offensive production out of Robert Williams. Yeah. But I just don't know if Time Lord is ready. Romeo Langford is still a rookie. You know, there just isn't a whole lot of spike there. Like, I guess Brad Wanamaker is going to get a lot of minutes.
Mm-hmm. And Grant Williams will get some time as well, just because.
Grant Williams. Yeah. So that's at least another wing, sort of like a 3-4 type of guy, who's strong as hell. You know what wouldn't surprise me? Semi Ojeleye. Just from the physical standpoint, like he would come in and not give up a lot of ground either, because he's arguably, like, per size, on a per size ratio, like the strongest dude in the league. I mean, he's just built.
Yes, he's a tank.
Completely. I think that would be an interesting player to throw into the mix, I think.
Yeah.
One question I have for you, and I know where I'm leaning on this. And I'm fully aware that today you can't say, well, player A matches up against player B, because it's in today's NBA, defensive switch a ton. But you can still have someone who primarily is on another team's player.
Mm-hmm.
And my question here is about Marcus Smart.
Mm.
Do you stick him on Lowry, or do you stick him on VanVleet as his primary assignment?
Yeah, I think I would go Lowry.
I'm going VanVleet.
Oh, interesting. Okay, why do you go VanVleet?
I think VanVleet, or is it VanVleet? I'm hearing both. It's VanVleet, right?
Yeah, VanVleet.
VanVleet. Oh, yeah. God. Get a better name, Fred.
Yeah. Well, he'll get a fat contract this summer. Then he'll maybe just lop off one of those two.
Right. I think offensively, Fred has gotten better than Kyle now.
Oh, interesting.
I think we've at that point, and that's not downgrading or downplaying what Kyle can do offensively. He's still a very, very dangerous player, but I think when you look at the way Fred is just manipulating defenses now, the way he's shooting the rock, the way he's just taking over that on-ball responsibility, it's like I think there's something there where I would feel far more certain if I'm the Celtics that I'm putting my primary defender on him as opposed to Kyle. It's almost a situation of knowing your enemy a little bit more. Like, Kyle, you know what you're getting. But, you know, VanVleet is still evolving. We're looking at his regular season numbers, and they were great. Like, 17.5 points, 6.5 assists, almost 2 steals, 39 from deep on high volume. But in the playoffs, it's different. He's still ascending. Yeah. And I think, you know, he's averaging 21, for example, here in the playoffs, shooting 56% from downtown. That's obviously not sustainable, but there's something there where you don't really know what you're getting, so might as well pull out the security blanket that is Marcus Smart.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. I was thinking more, you know, put Marcus Smart on Lowry, like cut off the head of the snake, basically. Like if you gum up their ability to get into their half-court offense, but it's not like, I mean, if you put whoever Smart is guarding, I think they'll ultimately just run their offense through the other guy. They're going to attack Kemba relentlessly in this matchup, as well they should. And I mean, Kyle Lowry did roll his ankle in that game four, I think, of that Nets series. So we're still waiting to hear about his status. Hopefully he's okay for Thursday. Because that could make that decision a lot easier. If Kyle Lowry's not in the starting lineup, there you go. You're putting Marcus Smart and Fred VanVleet and hiding Kemba wherever. But yeah, I mean, I would expect regardless that whichever guy Smart is not guarding, they're going to go after Kemba because he is the weak link in that starting lineup. And my question about one factor we haven't discussed really is, you know, size was supposed to be an issue for Boston in round one with Embiid and them only having Daniel Tice and Cantor and whatever. Clearly, they figured out a way to get around it. The Raptors are also very big with Gasol, Serge Ibaka.
Siakam.
Yeah, Siakam. So, like, do you think this is going to be their size disadvantage is going to be more of an issue in this series than it was in round one?
Not really. I think it's going to be a different look because, you know, it's Marc Gasol is not Joel Embiid. Like, he doesn't go down to the paint and, you know, asks for the ball 15 times a game. Like, his attack is more so from the outside when he's, like, when he's the one shooting. And otherwise, he's just, like, a facilitator passer type of guy. So they're going to have to be guarding him a little bit differently. But my point is, Gasol is not one of those guys who plays a lot of bully basketball. Right. He does on occasion, but he's not a guy who can sustain that level of play over a full series. I mean, this year he took 6 shots per game.
Yeah.
Average 7.5 points. He's not going to go into the Celtics series and going to be like, oh yeah, I'm dropping fools in the post and averaging 35, baby. Like, that's just not going to happen.
Right.
So you have to look at who gets the vast majority of the post touches. I haven't looked this up, but I am assuming it's Pascal. And then I'm assuming that Serge Ibaka is right behind him. So if that's true, those two would be like the primary players that you look at in terms of who can punish me on the inside. In which case, yeah, you're probably going to give up a couple buckets every single game just off of sheer size advantage. But is that going to be the thing that turns the whole series? I don't necessarily think so. Yeah, the Raptors might win one game just off sheerly off their size advantage.
Right.
But I don't think it's going to be like sustainable over the course of a full series. I mean, I realize that Brad Stevens was not the coach of the year, but he's still a damn good one, and I think he adjusts very well. By the way, I'm very much looking forward to Raptors fans and Celtics fans on Twitter arguing about who's the best coach for the next round.
Hey! Yeah, that's going to be really fun. But no, I agree with you on the point about, you know, they're not going to run their offense through Gasol in the paint. I do wonder if one of the possible adjustments we see in this series is matching Cantor's minutes with Gasol and Tice's minutes with Ibaka. But I mean, but Cantor is so bad as a pick and roll defender, and the Sixers couldn't really expose it because they don't have guards or guards who could create off the dribble, but really just guards in general. Right. Whereas, you know, Lowry and Fred VanVleet, I feel like anytime Cantor's on the floor, it's going to be whichever big man is on the floor with them. We are going to run a pick and roll every single damn time at Enes Kanter until he proves he can figure out how to stop it.
Yeah, as they should. As they should.
Yeah. So I'm seeing how the Celtics juggle their big man rotation. Like, we know what the Raptors are going to do. Seeing how the Celtics juggle theirs is going to be really interesting.
Right. Can I just plug a piece that I wrote for Forbes?
Yeah, please do.
So I wrote about having 2 6 men. You actually read that article. I know you did, because I sent it over to you asking you, am I completely off base here? And to my surprise, you were like, no, for once, you're actually being somewhat reasonable, which, great, I'm evolving. But I think for the Raptors, who have two six men in some capacity, Norman Powell and Serge Ibaka, you know, you brought up the lack of bench production. I think it's an interesting dynamic that you can actually pull in two players off the bench who are starting caliber players. Because let's face it, like Norman Powell could start on a lot of teams. Like, good Lord, he would be an instant Sixers starter immediately, yeah. And arguably their best guard. So, yeah. I think that is going to showcase, you know, the importance of depth. Because this is a continuation of what you preached last year about, instead of going with three stars, teams are pivoting to a two-star system.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows teams to have more financial flexibility that they can go spend on depth. So the Raptors, who have these two sixth men, they've done just that. They have a very, very thorough roster from 1 to 9, at least, if not 1 to 10. And I think for the Celtics, that's going to be a learning experience as well. They're going to look at that, and they're going to go, wow, you know, we have put so much into the starting unit,
yep,
that we don't really have a whole lot available off the bench. And that's going to be a priority for us. Even if we come out victorious of this series, like in the offseason, we got to make some drastic changes to our bench, because mm-hmm. it's just not good enough.
Yeah, and luckily they have 3 draft picks that they could use to build out their bench. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, they have Kemba he's on a full max, I believe. Jaylen Brown isn't a full max, but he's, you know, more than $25 million a year. Tatum is clearly going to get a max contract extension this summer. Like,
right,
this is part of the issue when you with a 3 or 4 star, because as the Sixers have proven, it's 3 or 4 guys on giant contracts.
yeah,
your bench depth fades quickly unless you nail, you know, the mid-level exception signings and your draft picks. So yeah, it's going to be a big area of focus for the Celtics moving forward. I know you said you're steering away from predictions. Again, I would have taken Boston had Hayward been healthy. I'm leaning Toronto slightly in this series, but I also, there's a real possibility that Tatum just goes, you know, absolutely. I mean, he's been phenomenal throughout the bubble. Like, he could very well keep that up. But I do think the Raptors have the defensive personnel to harass them into some poor shooting nights. And the size advantage, you know, even if it's not through offense, like, they could just totally own the glass throughout this series. Cut down on paint attempts, and also the depth. I mean, it would not surprise me to see Norman Powell swing a game in the series, Serge Ibaka swing a game in the series. So I'm leaning Toronto, but like you, I don't really care who wins. I just want it to go 7.
Yeah. I mean, so here's the thing. I will say this. If someone put a gun to my head, my first reaction would be Toronto. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to play out that way.
Yeah.
Because, again, Jason Tatum is just... Look, I realize the Raptors fans are going to hate me for this, but I don't think it's wrong. Like, I think Tatum is better than Siakam, and significantly so.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when you consider age. Like, next year is not going to be a contest.
Yeah.
No, but I've seen that narrative forming on Raptors Twitter a lot that Siakam is better, and I think we're as a collective Jason Tatum basketball is the best player in this series. Still sleeping on Jason Tatum, right?
Yeah, that's okay. Absolutely not.
Yeah. So yeah, depth Toronto advantage, and star power advantage is Boston.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let's wrap up quickly, Mort. We've got 2-2 series in the Western Conference. Unfortunately, those Blazers are not one, and Utah is shockingly up 3-1 against Denver, so it's hard to pick Denver to win 3 straight in this one. But Clippers Mavericks, Luka Doncic with the overtime heroics. My wife was watching the game with me, and as we were watching that last shot, she's like, wow, the Sixers could really use someone like that. So... She has correctly identified the Sixers' needs more than their front office has for the past 2 years, which is phenomenal.
Oh, my God. So did you bleed after she stuck that knife so deep in your gut?
No, I was like, I'm honestly just proud of you. You've recognized the value of guys who can create off the dribble. But what do you think happens moving forward? Kristaps Porzingis is out game five with this knee soreness that sidelined him in game four. So if you had to pick right now, Mort, who you got moving forward in this series?
Oh, man. See, I want to say Mavs, because I'm all in on this one right now, because what Luka did was, that was an all-timer. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just, that was maybe the craziest shot over the past 20 years, 25, 30 years, maybe even. It was insane. Completely insane. I just think the Clippers just have so much more going for them in terms of, like, their depth. But it all boils down to Paul George. That's where my concern lies, because, you know, on some level, I think the Clippers could pull this out, you know, no problem. But if George has not found that shot, and if he's just being consistently challenged and cannot figure out a way to overcome that Mavs defense, which really isn't that good. Like, the Mavs doesn't have a good defense, but for somehow it's just trickled Paul George. Then it's anybody's game.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to sit here and guess on the off chance that Paul George is going to continue shooting 3-14. I think he's bound to have a bounce back game at some point.
Yeah.
So if he does have that during the same game that Kristaps Porzingis is out, I think logic sort of dictates that this is probably LA's game to lose. Having said that, Luka just did what Luka did. I can't sit here and say Luka can't copy what he did last time. I can't. He just put up 43, 17, and 13 on a bum ankle, having his co-star missing a game, and then in the overtime, despite being down one, hitting a buzzer beater game winning. If I sat here and said, "Well, Luka can't duplicate that," I'd be an idiot.
Yeah.
So, gun to my head, Clippers, but I'm saying that not confident whatsoever.
In your heart of heart, you want the Mavericks, but your brain.
In my heart of heart, I want the Mavericks because I love this story, and I think Luka is. Look, you know what it is. I'll admit it. This is straight up bias, or not bias. This is revenge. This is revenge for me. I was so sickened, and still am, of the continued disrespect for Luka Doncic. And I'm at that point now where it's just the revenge. I've tasted revenge.
Yeah.
And it's sweet. It's tastes sweet, and I need more of it. I am revenge hungry. I am Batman.
You're going to have your own version of our retweet of Armageddon or whatever it's called, except don't do it because it backfires almost immediately.
I've had that periodically anyway. I have definitely taken screenshots that I posted. I'm not there, but I think it's a great story. That's really what it boils down to. This is a 21-year-old Slovenian kid who's basically taking the best of the best and putting them to shame. Did you see the reactions from NBA players around Twitter when Luka hit that shot? He had the greatest players in the game completely in awe. Completely in awe.
Yeah.
That's a great story. And also, that's the way you bring the NBA back, is to have great stories like this.
Mm-hmm.
I want the Cinderella trip because I think it would be fun.
Yeah, I agree. No, I'm with you, though. I'm picking the Clippers, but I would love to be wrong. Because, yeah, like you, I don't think Pandemic P is going to continue for three more games. Probably not even tonight, but we'll see. But Kawhi, it's hard to... I mean, as great as Luka has been, and I'm not pulling a Shaq here and saying, you know, like, I've seen better, whatever. Like, Luka has been phenomenal, but Kawhi has been equally Terminator-esque on the other end. Like, playoff Kawhi is a force to be reckoned with. So I hope this thing goes seven, just because it's been, I think, the most entertaining series in the first round. But picking the Clippers. What about OKC Houston, Mort?
That's the series I unfortunately have not seen the most of, because I had to cut off a little bit. I've been working so much that certain series had to be prioritized, to be fully honest with you. So I don't have the strongest finger on the pulse in terms of that series. What I have caught is that OKC just continues to be scrappy, though. That's really what have caught my eye. I mean, they were down, and they just keep coming back, and they're just one of those teams that I would fear the living hell out of by next year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've been, especially going down 2-0 and responding like this has been really impressive for them. I think this really ultimately comes down to Russell Westbrook status for this series. I haven't seen whether he's expected back anytime soon. I mean,
well, he was on the court yesterday. I saw that. He was barking at Steven Adams.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens on that front. I still slightly lean Houston here, but it does seem like the Thunder have really figured some things out here. I mean, Lou Dort has been absolutely phenomenal defensively, and it seems like they've kind of figured out that, you know, Steven Adams is a big piece to what they do, and he would be important, especially if they move on and face the Lakers with that size. But, you know, against a small ball team like the Rockets, they have the three guards, Paul, SGA, Schroeder, Lou Dort guarding Harden, and then Gallo, like center Gallo, which is just what basketball is in 2020, and it's working. So I don't know. I mean, if Russ comes back, that just helps give Houston something, like that, some element of unpredictability, and, you know, kind of just that explosiveness that they've been missing. Like, he right. will, they, you know, they're jacking 50 plus threes a game. I don't think that's going to change, but Russ would give them a little more off the dribble chops that they are currently lacking. But man, if Russ doesn't come back, I mean, I picked the Thunder in this series before, and if Russ doesn't come back, I think I'm sticking with it.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I've also heard, I have not seen it a whole lot, that Eric Gordon is basically playing a ton of great defense as well, which mm-hmm. is interesting. That's definitely a key factor. Jeff Green, I'm going to give you props.
Yeah.
17-6 a game. It's a weird age to break out in. One note I do have, and I think this is intriguing, or not intriguing, interesting is probably the better word. So you have Lou Dort, who is like, I think is he 21 or is he still 20? Either way, he's really young.
Mm-hmm.
And he's already being this very influential defender in the NBA, in the postseason no less, which really should end the narrative that rookies can't have. You can't be influential when they come in, because this is proving this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think at some point the Oklahoma City Thunder might want this defensive wing that they have to be able to shoot? Because now it's stored.
Right.
And they had Diallo and Ferguson. Like, at some point, they're going to need one of these guys to be able to make a three-point basket. Like, Andre Roberson is another. They have four perimeter defenders who can't shoot.
Yeah. It's just their thing. But hey, Darius Bazley is giving them some nice offense off the bench. So maybe they'll just always have guards who can't shoot, but they can make up for it in other areas.
In the front court?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say, on the Jeff Green note, Kevin O'Connor of The Ringer had a really good feature on him about, kind of, you know, I think it was something of like his ninth life, or he's like finally breaking out his ninth life in the NBA. But just kind of teasing at the whole, you know, Jeff Green has frustrated in terms of his potential versus his reality at basically every stop throughout his NBA career. But this small ball five, like the inverse 5-1 pick and rolls that they run where James Harden sets the screen for Jeff Green. It's like, those are a thing of beauty, man. It's been really fun watching this series unfold. And I know people are sick of watching the Rockets jack up a billion threes, but look past that, and some of the other strategic decisions on both sides have been really, really interesting. It's a good chess match between D'Antoni and Billy Donovan.
If you want to feel old, Jeff Green is going to be 34 on August 28th, three days from now.
Well, on that note, I'm going to go rethink my life decisions. So yep. Hope you all enjoyed today. Hope you're staying safe out there. Please follow us at the NBA Pod on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Don't die.
Thank you, you too.